And we're back. Thanks for staying tuned to WVFF 97.7 FM and now more true crime in the Lowcountry.
The change of clothes was around 12:30 at night, and he had not been detained at this time. It wasn't until an hour later when he was detained, and of course they didn't take his clothes and he didn't interview him. So, according to eyewitnesses.
Oh, so he hadn't changed his clothes?
No, he has not changed his clothes. I mean, he changed his clothes before he was interviewed, before he was detained for a brief time by law enforcement.
Okay.
So he was allowed to change his clothes. But there is body cam footage, isn't there? That's what?
That is what is alleged, that he changed clothes before police had detained him.
So there's
body cam. There would be body camera footage of him walking around wearing one outfit and then him walking around wearing a different outfit.
That's correct. And that's new evidence, by the way. That's new evidence that I have posted in the article. We're going to present that to SLED because SLED has closed this case. And there's been no one arrested in this particular case and no one prosecuted for this case. The case is closed. They would reopen the case only based off of new and credible evidence, according to this particular...
The coroner deemed... Was there an autopsy?
There was. There was an autopsy done at MUSC the next morning by the... chief medical examiner and head medical examiner. The associated findings were very descriptive. I do have those online as well, but they did classify this as a homicide.
Oh, as a homicide?
Yes.
Hmm.
It was not classified as a suicide. It was classified as a homicide.
The case because they didn't think they could make a case that they could bring to trial, I guess. They recognized that
the opinion.
Homicide.
The opinion reads, and I quote, "This 14-year-old white male, Caden Thomas Lee Moses, died as a result of a gunshot wound to the head. The manner of death is homicide."
Now, suicide isn't considered homicide in South Carolina, is it?
No. Suicide is suicide.
Yeah, no, I'm just say because, you know, there could be a distinction that, you know, either homicide or natural causes. Obviously, it wasn't natural causes, but he said it was homicide.
Right.
Interesting.
So what Jim is doing, he wants to reopen the case, obviously. It wasn't properly investigated. There's enough evidence there to go further than SLED went, I guess is a fair thing to say, right, Jim?
Yeah, according to the mother, the solicitor told her that he could prosecute it if she really wanted to. But it probably wouldn't end in a conviction. But they've since closed the case. However, when I talk about new evidence, so she tried to do a FOIA for the body cam video, and she was not denied. But what she was told was that she may not have the video. She can only have the audio. But I've spoken to many eyewitnesses, and when I investigated this, and everybody said that Henry was walking around. Henry admitted to putting bullets in the gun. Henry admitted to taking bullets out of the gun. And you have a sister who said she was changing clothes with him, and then she's also witnessed leaving the vehicle with pants on and entering back into the vehicle with shorts on. Now, how does that make any evidence? Well, what you have is, if in fact this is what happened, as alleged by the eyewitness, you have a few things. You have one, you have an accessory after the fact, and this charge which would apply when someone's assisting a person who has committed a crime such as murder or manslaughter with the intent to help them avoid arrest, prosecution, or conviction. And if we allege what happens, helping the shooter change clothes to hide gunpowder residue, this would mean that the mother and the sister could possibly be charged with accessory after the fact. They could also be charged with tampering of evidence if they were actively participating in the concealment of destruction of evidence. We don't know what happened to those pants. Obstruction of justice, of course, assisting in the cover-up or hiding of evidence, and conspiracy, which we know is two or more people conspiring to impede investigations. These are all felonies, and with considerable amount of jail time with the mother, the sister, and Henry. If Slit just contacts the people who have told me the same thing in this interview, they'll confirm exactly what I've wrote in the article. And in fact, how they can prove it is to go into their own video, body cam video, and see what clothes, because Henry was walking around everywhere in the house, in the yard, and if there was police officers walking in and around, they're going to have him on body cam video. It would be pretty easy to see if he's wearing the same clothes when they first saw him versus, you know, sometime after 12:30 at night, and when he was detained, especially because there would have been an officer that would have led him over to the vehicle. So I'm assuming his body cam was on, and they're going to get pretty good close-up video of Henry and what clothes he was wearing. If those clothes don't match up with what eyewitnesses said they saw him in earlier that night, then one would be able to say, well, it would appear that he's changed clothes to cover up a crime or to help mislead or impede the investigation.
Now, the question I have is, this case is less than a year old. All right. It's less than a year old. They ruled it a homicide.
Correct.
And they closed the case?
Yeah.
Doesn't that seem like awful quick or a lack of integrity on the part of Sled?
So, here's the question you have. Is there a connection between Henry and law enforcement? Any connection, however tenuous, between... Because why would law enforcement do this? Maybe they're just really busy and they've got so many murders they don't have time to look at this one. That's a possibility. Maybe space aliens came down and stole their homework and they lost their incentive to follow up the case. That's, you know, a possibility, I guess. But here's one, that there is some odd connection that somehow weakened the will of law enforcement to pursue this case. And I think that's the concern. You know, 10 million people are concerned about this set of facts. And I think what it speaks to is we really want law enforcement we want to support law enforcement, but we want them to support us in return and do their job.
As I understand it, Henry has a stepmother that worked for the county court, and he may have had one or two other relatives. I do know for a fact that a couple of the Lawrence County sheriffs one or two of the deputies had to recuse themselves because their sons were friends with Henry and or Caden, so they had to recuse him. So it's a small county. It's a very small town. I'm trying to find where the letter is. I'll find it here. I'm trying to find where the letter is.
Well, you're looking for that, Jim. I just want to fill this in a bit. This woman contacted you after she had contacted lots of other people. She reached out to a lot of people. And possibly she has followed you on TikTok because of your coverage of Alec Murdoch. And she knew about you with the both books, Defending Alec Murdoch, Not Guilty by Reasonable Doubt, and Juror 785, Because Enough is Enough. And so did she contact you because she thought that you are sort of a champion for justice, or at least somebody willing to take a fresh look at evidence, I guess is the best way to put it. Is that kind of fair? Is that how you got contacted? You didn't seek her out. She sought you out.
I didn't. No. Right. She sought me out. I didn't seek her out when I heard the story. I forget how she contacted me. It might have been on TikTok. I was like, what is this?
You mentioned it to me, and I said, I remember saying, doesn't resonate with me, Jim. I just don't see, you know, people die every day. I don't see this having any traction at all, which is, you know, one of these fabulous examples of me being incredibly wrong about the importance of this story. I couldn't have been more wrong. But it speaks to this. Every single life is important. Every single life is important. And I think I even said to you something. I can't think of what could be more insulting than to say, well, you need some kind of hook to grab the public's attention. And bless your heart, the hook was that you actually investigated it. And with the facts, it grabbed 10 million people's attention. And I just, I'm so proud of you for, one, ignoring my advice, of course, but simply sticking to this and doing the boots on the ground, the actual door-to-door, knocking on doors research to understand what happened. I know you've looked at police files, and you don't have a bias about this. You didn't have any assumptions going in or any bias going in. You're not related to this woman, and you don't have an axe to grind or a contract to fulfill or any monetary reason for pursuing this.
No, in fact, there's a GoFundMe page that I put up on one of the articles, not only to help with the family and the medical issues that they have ongoing with the children who saw their brother murdered in their own home, but for a tombstone for the boy, as well as money for an attorney, because if she doesn't get closure on this from law enforcement, she's going to pursue civil action against the boy and the family. So there is a GoFundMe page up there. In fact, I just released all that to her this afternoon, so she has access to that. I think it's much needed for her. So at the GoFundMe page, just go look up Kaden Moses, and it's Kaden, K-A-D-E-N, Moses, M-O-S-E-S. The letter she received, it's just kind of in closing, the letter she received from SLED, from a Thomas H. Robinson, major from the Investigative Services, says on May 3rd, 2024, she attended, said you attended, it would be Erica attended a meeting with our investigators, our victims advocate, and the Lawrence County Coroner. Deputy Solicitor Josh Thomas, during the interview, and you were briefed on the facts of the case. She doesn't believe she was briefed on the facts of the case. She's asked for documentation for it, and she has not been given that. On June 14th, 2024, Deputy Solicitor Thomas issued a letter to Special Agent Merrill declining prosecution in this matter. Simply put, there is just not sufficient evidence to charge anyone with a crime based on the information that we now have. Ms. Moses, the investigation is thorough and complete based on the facts and information that we have at this time.
Oh, wow. Thorough and complete. Thorough and complete. They didn't take any evidence. They didn't take fingerprints of anybody. They didn't test for GSR of anybody. Not thorough. The investigation was incompetent and sloppy.
Do you know when they interviewed Henry and the rest of the family?
Let me take a wild guess and say never.
No, they did, but it was 4 to 6 weeks after the murder. And Henry showed up with an attorney and invoked his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. And then it finishes up here. It says, Ms. Moses, the investigation is thorough, complete, facts and information we have at this time. Please understand that this case, like many others, leaves unanswered questions, questions that answers may never be known. I don't know why they threw that in there. And if credible, and the word credible is bold, evidence is discovered, this case will be reopened and the investigation will continue until such time SLED considers this matter closed. Please do not hesitate to contact me. Blah, blah, blah. So it was 4 to 6 weeks after the murders that these people were investigated. Now, you want to talk about memories and things being lost in time. Nobody had their statements taken that night. It was 4 to 6 weeks later, and Henry chose to invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege, which is his privilege. However, the mother was told by not only the, well, she was told by the special agent in charge with the solicitor in the room hearing her say this, and I have yet to find evidence of this anywhere, that this would be true, but according to her, she said that they interviewed him that one time, and according to South Carolina law, according to her, they can only interview him one time, and they got their one time, and he said, I'm not answering questions, and now they can't talk to him ever again, according to the mother and what she was told.
Wow.
Now, here's a question. Here's a question for you, Elaine. Based on the fact that there was no, that the investigation stalled, obviously, the criminal investigation, what
it
is
never
the.
Got started. It didn't stall.
Yeah,
didn't
well, start. Listen, semantics.
No one put the key in the ignition and even tried to turn the key to start the investigation.
You
yeah, but anyway.
You don't want me to ask you a question. What is the likelihood that a civil case can be successful?
Successful?
If there was no... Now, let's
short
go...
Short answer, Frank, I can answer this right now. The likelihood of success in a civil action is directly tied to the attorney representing this woman, Caden's mother. And the attorney right now, in my experience, I'm 70, I've experienced some of the best, including Jerry Spence, the best attorneys that ever lived, coast to coast, all around this country, all kinds of cases. If this mother could get Mark Tinsley to take this case, I would say the likelihood that there will be some satisfaction is upwards of 98%. Any other attorney, who knows? And, you know, we've talked about this before. I am not a big fan of Mark Tinsley. I think he has a reckless disregard for some of the cherished fundamental tenets of the law. But he is as tenacious as he's worse than a weasel. He is a fisher. He's that super weasel that eats other weasels, and he's tenacious. So if he just, you know, got hit in the head by a brick of insight, and had the impulse to represent this mother, I think he could do a tremendous amount of good because he is just, you know, so tenacious, and he will convert. You see, what's happened is law enforcement, they didn't drop the ball. They never picked up the ball. And they get away with, they do that because they can. People engage in this kind of conduct because they've done it in the past, and it's worked in the past because it's pretty bold. What they've done here with this sham farce of calling what they did an investigation, the only way you would say such an idiot, make, you know, write that, draft that letter that Jim just read, is you have the confidence that you've gotten away with it in the past. So you need an attorney that's not going to let you get away with it, and that is Mark Tinsley. So let's all together, you know, what is this? We're going to sort of, visualize Mark representing this woman, and good things will happen.
Now,
that's my theory.
Now, in the O.J. Simpson case, all right, he was found not guilty for the murder.
He was acquitted of the murders. Yeah.
All right, but he was found guilty in the civil suit.
He was found liable in the civil suit.
All right, liable.
And had a, I think it was a $42 million. I forget how. I think that with penalties and stuff and interest, the liability in that civil action was around $100 million.
Would
by
that
the time
be?
He died, but I didn't really follow it.
Would that be somewhat comparable to this crime?
I don't know. I don't know. That's a kind of wild speculation. There's some malfeasance here. There's some rocks people need to be looking under. But when you go into court, good cases settle. And they settle because you've got the right set of facts in the right jurisdiction with the right statutory law, and you've got the right attorney who gets the case in order and knows how to successfully bring a case to settlement. And that's what you want in this case. You want a settlement. And I think that somebody like Mark Tinsley would do it. And you know, at the opposite end of the scale, I would avoid every other attorney that was in that courtroom during the prosecution of Alec Murdoch, completely. I'd run screaming from each and every one of them on either side of the table, whether it's the prosecution or the defense, or maybe especially the defense. But, you know, there's a lot of legal talent in South Carolina that you just scratch your head and say, how do you have that reputation? We don't see evidence that you have that skill. Mark Tinsley has, it's not so much the skill, it's the relentless determination to advocate for his client. It pushing the rules of professional conduct to the breaking point and possibly even going beyond, but he is a super advocate for his client. And this mother needs that because what she's experienced, just the trauma. How do her kids, her surviving kids who've seen their brothers, you know, I don't even want to describe it because it's very graphic, but they saw that, processing that will take their life. You know, it's a lifetime.
Yeah. Jim, is there a possibility that there may have been an actor other than Henry involved in this? Discounting, you know, the post-homicide testimonies of these people, is there anyone else that you think could have possibly done this other than Henry?
No one else was in the room.
Yes, all right, but that's...
Because you have the FaceTime, Frank. You have the FaceTime.
Oh, that's interesting. You have
Caden's that... girlfriend.
Right.
Also have that Caden is engaged in this game that requires that he's using both hands. But at one point, I think that Henry's girlfriend had turned off her FaceTime, but Caden's girlfriend did not. And so she's aware of where Henry is sitting, and she's also aware of what there is nobody else in the room. There was no other party in the house. There's a little more to this, though. The gun that Caden had was a gift to him, and it was not loaded. It was kept unloaded. And the bullets for that gun were outside in Caden's truck, which I guess he really didn't have access to yet because he was still a minor. He was only 14, but it was part of, I think, a birthday gift or something. Anyway, there was some control that the mother had exercised to keep bullets separate from that gun. That's one. And so when Jim talked about this, that when he comes out of the shower and realizes that Henry is out in the yard, there's speculation that Henry got a hold of the keys to the truck. And that's when, you know, because Henry's talking about my fingerprints are going to be on the gun and on this shelf. It's because he had gone out for whatever reason and loaded the gun. Now, maybe, we don't know, maybe Henry was still angry. You know, this thing that the fight had been resolved, maybe the fight wasn't resolved. I don't know. You know, we don't know Henry's motivation.
Rich, I reached out to a representative of the family because there was people from the family that were making comments on my YouTube video. So I reached out to them for a comment to get their side of the story, to get Henry's side of the story. I have not received a message back. As far as the gun goes, so here's the thing: his mother and father were in the middle of a divorce. They were separated, living in separate homes at the time. His dad and Caden were deer hunting, and like any good hunter, the gun was emptied at the end of their hunt. The father witnessed it. The shells were put up, and the gun was put into a gun travel bag and zipped up. And they drove what was going to be Caden's truck because he was going to turn 15 soon in January. So when they got out of the truck, the father had a set of the keys. The mother had a set of the keys. The father locked the vehicle because the vehicle was still locked when she checked it. But they locked the vehicle, so there was ammunition in the vehicle. And then the mother has a gun safe with guns in it and other ammunition. That was locked. She had the keys for both in her bedroom. I don't recall where, somewhere in a drawer or something along those lines. But remember, she went to sleep and was in bed because she had to get up early. So the gun came into the home, and according to Erica, she said when she came in, she double-checked the gun to make sure that it was unloaded, whether that was she did it physically and via by her sight, or she asked Caden. But The gun was not loaded when it came into the house, and there was no ammunition that was readily available to anybody. She did end up finding the keys to the truck months later, in between her washer and her dryer, kind of underneath the washer.
In the garage?
Ironically enough, that you have to go by the washer and dryer to get out into the garage. So if somebody had the car keys, then that's where they were dumped.
You know, due to such a poor investigation, there's so many questions that are left unanswered.
You know, I read between the lines. I read between the lines on what this investigator with SLED says. The investigation is thorough and complete. And then he goes on to say, on the facts and information that we have at this time, I don't believe SLED's going to throw Lawrence County Sheriff's Department underneath the bus on this one, but it feels like I'm reading between the lines. Like, SLED kind of has their hands tied. The solicitor kind of has their hands tied because to them, they don't have any direct physical evidence of anything. They don't have any clothes. They don't have any GSR kits. They don't have any, well, that I know of, any fingerprints taken, at least at the scene. They don't have any DNA taken at the scene. And you have the only person who was with Caden when he was alive is taking the fifth. So how do they prove that? I don't know how they prove that, but I do know that there's new evidence, as far as I'm concerned, of possible accessory after the fact, obstruction of justice and tampering with evidence, with possible notion, according to witness testimony, that the sister changed clothes with Henry before law enforcement could talk to him, hold him, or you know, put him anywhere. But he was just walking around the front yard, coming in the house, walking in and out of the house, talking to people, went to the neighbor's house, came back. He was walking around freely. Why wouldn't you talk to him? I mean, my first question was, who was the last person that saw Caden alive? Henry. Somebody go get me Henry. Go get your mom. We need to talk to you. Somebody go get
Henry. Wait, Henry's mom was at the crime scene pretty fast. But here's the deal. The state of South Carolina is about to execute this man. And Frank and I talked about it a little bit this morning on the radio show, the First Cup. And I think he was overcharged. I think this is wrong. But we want law enforcement to get it right. I want to use, if we have a surplus in the budget, let's pay law enforcement so that we have enough people, enough members of law enforcement that are well enough educated, well enough trained, that are being paid enough that rather than go work in the private sector, they're willing to work for law enforcement. You know, we don't want to have the pay so low that we're just not attracting what we need. We frankly need our best and our brightest to be defending us from this kind of activity. And I don't think that's what we're getting. I think we're getting something that's actually frightening when you take a second look at it. And the real concern is there are so many cases where nobody ever takes a second look at it. They just don't. And so it does get swept under the rug. And, you know, when I said this a few minutes ago about Mark Tinsley, if he would represent this woman, I think the reason that he might not is because there is no pot of gold here. You can't tie some wealthy company.
Wrong. He can sue the Lawrence County Sheriff's Department for ineffective investigation. He can also sue Lud if he chose to include them in on that. So the county.
Okay, but when you go for the king, you better make sure that you take him out completely. But I don't know how many. Again, then we get right back to there aren't a lot of attorneys willing to take on this kind of case, which is sad, which is really, really sad. I wish this mother all the best. You know, I hope she finds a terrific attorney that aggressively defends her against people that either aided and abetted maybe this young man cannot be held accountable for whatever reason, but people that aided and abetted him possibly can. People that obstructed justice possibly can. Obstruction of justice and aiding and abetting are elements of the lawsuit that I have in New York right now. So
yeah,
I
all right, but let's talk
claims.
About. Well, we have only have a couple of minutes, but let's talk about something. If you're going to talk about aiding and abetting, if you're going to talk about conspiracy, you have to have a suspect or somebody that's been convicted. All right?
No, you don't have to have somebody that's been convicted. It depends on...
How can you have aiding and abetting if you don't have somebody convicted?
Let's say there's a... Well, here's the answer. Let's say there's a criminal investigation. By the way, he said accessory after the fact. That's one. There's a criminal investigation that involves somebody, and a third party decides that investigation will... expose them to public scrutiny that will cause them to lose hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue, in ad revenue and other kinds of joint business ventures that they have to broadcast this product that they have or whatever. They can be sued for aiding and abetting without even the resolution of the criminal. You can aid and abet or obstruct justice in a criminal investigation regardless of the outcome of that investigation. It's the obstructing justice. It's when you act to do that you are guilty of aiding and abetting. And if there's a criminal penalty for it, and sometimes there, or a civil penalty for it, private citizens, we don't bring criminal cases. The state brings that. But we can bring civil cases to say I'm damaged because you aided and abetted.
I can see an obstructive justice. I can see an obstructive justice, all right, because you're preventing investigation of the crime. But what was the other term that Jim used?
Accessory after the fact.
Tampering.
Right.
Tampering with evidence.
No, listen. Tampering with evidence.
Yeah, that could be valid. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. to accessory after the fact, you have to have somebody convicted to have accessory after the fact.
So let me ask you this though: if you're the mother. And you're the sister, and you're now separated, and you have maybe an attorney with you, but you have been separated, and you have now police telling you that these are crimes that you could be committed, that you could be charged with, and these have prison time, a decade or more of prison time. That could, that in itself... If Henry were to have said anything to either of those two, that in itself may induce them to want to be more open with what actually happened.
Not if they ever talk to an attorney.
Well,
you know, I mean...
We're talking about the nuances of law.
No, well, we're not talking about the nuances of law. But what we're saying
you're
is
about accessory after the fact.
You throw that around
to be the fact.
Yes, think, but you throw that Mike's around. Right, but actually, you have to have
the fact.
A fact. And if you don't have a fact, how could you have an accessory?
Well, you have after the fact. The fact is the boy was wearing certain clothes. It's alleged that he changed clothes. So now you have video evidence to be able to go and look and see, did he change clothes? And if, in fact, that is true,
that could be an obstruction of justice.
Now you have the fact that he changed clothes. Well, then you have to ask yourself, why did he change clothes? And now you have not just one witness, but you have five other witnesses in a vehicle that will say the same thing that said, his mother called him. She said her mother called her, and she said that Henry needed a change of clothes. And then she came back with shorts on, which means she changed her clothes and put on a pair of shorts at the crime scene.
Yeah, Jim, changing clothes isn't a crime. Frank is right about this, I think. But there might be a question of it might be a finding of fact for the jury rather than a matter of law for a judge.
Well, I mean,
first of all, we're not
sure
about this. But I agree with Frank that you actually have to have, and so. Here's the thing. The kid could be, if the kid is convicted of any part of this, I think this is, if the gun was muzzled, we got something else. But if the gun just went off while he's playing with it, when he stupidly loaded it, this could all be some version of manslaughter. So to me, the bigger crime is the adults who interfered with the police investigation. And
the Flint agent did ask the mother about a damaged jacket, and she was not quite following the agent when she said that. And it's something that needs to be followed up on, but she was questioned by the Flint agent about a damaged jacket.
Well, guys, where do you want to leave this? Where do you want to leave this today? Where do you want to leave it? Now, there's real simple.
One person, Jim Kask, you know, Crimen Kask, brought this thing to light, breathed life into it, and now we're talking about, it's that vague term about justice. We are close to actually having some semblance of justice for Caden. And, you know, that's a vague term. It's a vague, ambiguous term, actually, even though it shouldn't be. But some sort of accountability is possible. You know, people say, well, I'm only one person, and what can I do? Well, Jim's only one person, and this is what he did. 10 million people care, and very likely care enough to get either SLED to reopen the criminal investigation or to get some really good attorney to represent Caden's mother in a civil action. But either way,
right. She
is 10 million people further down the road toward getting her son's... This is a brutal death. And any mother understands. She just simply wants to know. She's not trying to milk this so she can, you know...
No.
My question
is this. We have something pending. We have something pending that we can carry on further next week. Is there you have FOIA stuff requested, right?
911 call. I don't know if you're going to want to play the 911 call.
No. You might want to discuss the transcript.
Yeah.
I would certainly discuss the transcript. I'd feel comfortable doing that. The 911 call, I'm kind of skeptical with that.
But, Frank, we got all kinds of – Jim has been a busy young man, and there are other stories. In fact, there was something else, but we're out of time.
Yes, exactly. So that's where I'm going.
To the grindstone. Yeah, he's out there producing. He's out producing all other true crime platforms combined with – stories like this, which is, I think, absolutely incredible. Which reminds me, if anybody saw, what's it called, Escape at Dannemora, I think Jim should get an interview with that woman. I think her last name was Mitchell. You know, the bored housewife, the one that was the head of the tailor shop that actually aided and abetted those guys, facilitated the two escapees from getting out of jail. And she served her, she pled guilty, served seven. She got sentenced to 7 years. I think she only had to serve five. She's now out. Supposedly, she's back with her husband. He stayed with her through all of this. But I think Jim should get an interview with her to get her side of that story, because she's never actually spoken to anybody beyond a few, you know, get away from me, get that microphone out of my face kind of comments.
Well, listen, let's put this to bed for today. And Jim, whatever we need to do to support you, other than send you a check, of course, let's keep this open, and next week we'll carry on and we'll see we'll dive deeper into what we've got so far, and we'll see if anything new materialized. Is it agreed?
Okay.
All right.
I appreciate that. Thank
hey
you.
Guys,
yeah.
I thank you too much, and this is True Crime in the Lowcountry. And you're listening to WVFF 97.7 LPFM, Red Brick Patriot Radio, broadcasting from Cottageville, South Carolina. And we're out of here, guys. And folks, thank you very much both for your intellect and your hard work. Ciao now. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
Bye-bye.